This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
According to multiple reports, the trustee overseeing Nick Reiner's individual trust fund is preparing to ask a judge to release the money. Not fighting it, not blocking it, asking the court to hand it over. A hearing has reportedly been scheduled for August. And if a judge signs off, the money that Rob and Michelle Reiner set aside for their son when he was an infant will allegedly be used to hire the defense attorney representing him against charges that he stabbed them to death in their Brentwood home. Hard to see that one coming a mile away. I mean, not today. And a mile away, I don't mean earlier this year. I'm saying when he was an infant. Let's put this away for him. He'll use it someday to hire Alan Jackson to represent him in our own murders. You've been asking me about this for months. Different words, same fury. How is this legal? Can he really use their money for this? Doesn't the law stop this? And we're going to get into all that today. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. The short answer is the law that's supposed to stop this, the Slayer statute, only kicks in after a conviction or a civil finding. I've broken that down before. I've covered estate of Ladd, the NGRI loophole, the preponderance standard, all of it. Go watch those episodes if you need the full legal picture. But this episode isn't about whether the law will eventually catch up. It's about why the law can't stop what's happening right now. And the answer isn't a broken statute. The answer is a trust document that was written in 1993, signed when Nick Reiner was a baby, and reportedly never updated to account for the possibility that circumstances might change. He may not be the adorable, bubbling baby that he was when he was small. I also have a hard time believing that he was ever that. Three provisions. That's what was allegedly missing. Three clauses that estate attorneys draft every day for families dealing with situations far less extreme than this one. Any one of them built into that trust at any point over the last 32 years would have made this petition legally impossible. The hearing wouldn't be scheduled. The argument wouldn't exist. The money wouldn't be moving. And I'm going to walk you through all three. But first, you need to understand what the trust actually says, because that's where the whole thing breaks, okay? And if you haven't hit subscribe yet, please do. The Reiner Children's Trust was established in 1993. According to the probate petition, Rob and Michelle Reiner created individual trusts for each of their children, Nick, Jake, and Romy. These were reportedly funded independently of the larger Reiner family trust and the broader estate. The terms of Nick's trust allegedly required half of the funds to be distributed when he turned 30, which happened before the murders, a couple years before the murders. And the other half when he turned 35. Mandatory distributions. Fixed ages, no conditions attached. Nick turned 30 on September 14th, 2023. That was 27 months before his parents were killed. According to the petition, nobody has explained why the money wasn't released to him then. His parents were alive, no crime had been committed. The distribution date came and went, and the money reportedly stayed in the trust. His legal team's entire argument starts there. If the trust required a payout at 30 and the payout never happened, then the money stopped being trust property on that date. It became his legally, regardless of what happened 27 months later. That's the argument. And Whether you find it enraging or legally sound, and I know most of you find it enraging, it exists because of how the trust was structured. Mandatory payouts at set ages, no off switch, no mechanism for the trustee to say, hold on, the circumstances have changed. We need to pump the brakes. The trust, I mean, it's right in the name, trust, which is very hard to have in anybody. The trust was reportedly designed to function like a vending machine. Put in the birthday, out comes the money. And once it vests, even a murder charge allegedly can't pull it back because the money was technically his before anyone died. And I want to be clear about something. The Reiners weren't negligent. They weren't careless. They did what the vast majority of families do when they set up a trust for their kids. They picked reasonable ages. They funded the accounts. They trusted the process. In 1993, nobody's sitting in a lawyer's office thinking about worst case scenarios for their infant son. What if he becomes a killer? You're thinking about college. You're thinking about a first apartment. You're thinking about giving your kid a financial foundation when they're old enough to use it. That's what this trust was, a gift written with love, structured with the default settings that most trusts use and never revisited as the years went by and the circumstances got darker. Eric Richens, Corey Richens' case, figure that part out. Different case, different state, different set of facts entirely. But the principle is identical. When he saw trouble coming in his marriage, he went to an estate attorney, rewrote his trust, moved control away from his wife, and put his sister in charge of his children's future. He reportedly updated the documents. It didn't save his life, but according to court records, it saved his children's inheritance after his wife was convicted of his murder. One family updated. One reportedly didn't. That one decision is the difference between protection and exposure, and it's the reason we're having this conversation right now. So why wouldn't it have taken? Or so what would have taken, I guess, is more the question. What could have been built into the Reiner Trust at creation or at any point over the last three decades that would have made this petition dead on arrival? Well, less than you think. Three clauses, and the first one would have ended this fight before it started. The first provision is called an indictment freeze. In plain English, it's a clause written into the trust that automatically suspends all distributions the moment a beneficiary is charged with a violent crime against the person who created the trust or another beneficiary. Not convicted, charged. The criminal filing triggers the freeze. No trustee discretion needed. No emergency court petition. No scramble to figure out what the trust allows. The language is already in the document waiting. The moment charges are filed, the money stops moving by the trust's own terms. Doesn't matter if you didn't get it early when you were supposed to get it. Boom, it's game over. Think about how that changes the Reiner situation. The petition argues that the trustee has no legal bias to withhold Nick's funds, that the money vested at 30, and it's his as a matter of right. An indictment freeze written into that trust is the legal basis. It doesn't require a judge to weigh in. It doesn't depend on the Slayer statute, which needs a conviction or a civil finding to activate. It doesn't care where the money technically vested before the crime. The clause says if you're charged with a violent crime against the people who set up this trust, distributions are frozen until the criminal case resolves. If you're convicted, the Slayer statute takes the money permanently. If you're acquitted, the freeze lifts and you get what's yours. But during the window between arrest and resolution, which is exactly where Nick Reiner's petition lives, the money doesn't move. The petition wouldn't exist. The hearing wouldn't be on the calendar. The argument about vesting dates would be irrelevant because the trust anticipated exactly that scenario. Every comment I get that says, how is this even legal? Is really asking one question. Why doesn't the trust have an indictment freeze? That's the question. And the answer is that most trusts don't, because most families never think they'll need one. Simple answer. The second provision is what estate attorneys call a discretionary trust structure, or what I'm calling the discretionary shield. Instead of mandatory distributions at fixed ages, the trust gives the trustee full discretion over whether, when, and how much to distribute. No vesting dates, no automatic payouts. The trustee evaluates the beneficiary's circumstances, their financial stability, their mental health, their legal situation, their ability to manage money, and decides Nick's legal argument allegedly runs on one word, mandatory. The trust reportedly requires a payout at 30. His attorneys say that made it his money by right outside of any trustee supervision. A discretionary trust eliminates that word from the equation entirely. There's nothing to vest, nothing that becomes a beneficiary's as a matter of right. The trustee could look at a beneficiary's history of substance abuse or mental health crises, their legal troubles, and say, not yet. Not until the situation stabilizes. And that decision would be legally defensible because the trust gave them the authority to make it. Now, I'll be honest about the trade-off here because it matters. Discretionary trust put enormous power in the trustee's hands. A bad trustee can withhold money from a beneficiary who genuinely needs it. A trustee with their own agenda can use that discretion as leverage. That's a real concern, and it's one of the reasons a lot of estate attorneys default to mandatory distributions. They're clean, they're predictable, they remove the human element, but the alternative to the human element is that a trust that pays out on autopilot, regardless of circumstances, may pay out to someone who shouldn't be getting that money. A trust that can't respond to addiction, can't respond to instability, can't respond to a criminal charge. A trust that became a vending machine for someone who allegedly shouldn't be anywhere near the money. That's the trade-off. And right now we're watching what happens when the autopilot version meets the worst case scenario. And look, the vending machine clearly wasn't working because he didn't get the money. He might have been kicking there, the vending machine, hitting it, putting that dollar bill in, and it keeps coming out. Remember those days? It wasn't giving him what he wanted. So, I mean, it didn't quite function as designed, but now it's going to be held up to legal scrutiny. In the worst case of scenario, the third provision is the behavioral trigger, sometimes called the incentive trust. Distributions are conditioned on specific verifiable benchmarks: sobriety, clean drug tests, no criminal history, compliance with treatment recommendations. I mean, you're going to predict these things when he's a baby? Hey, if he complies with his treatment, like, what are we talking about? He's an infant. Completions of specific programs. The trust doesn't just hand over money at a birthday. It requires evidence that the beneficiary is in a position to handle it responsibly. And according to public reporting, Nick Reiner had a well-documented history of struggles, to put it lightly, with substance abuse and mental health. His own father reportedly had a semi-autobiographical film made about it. The history wasn't a secret. The behavioral trigger built into the trust at any point, not just at creation in 1993, but at any review, any update, any moment when the family sat down with their attorney and said, we're worried about our son, could have created a mechanism to pause or condition distributions based on his circumstances, not as punishment, as protection for him and for the family. The trust became a tool that says, we love you, we want you to have this money, and we need to see evidence that you're in a place to use it well before we release it. Call it coercive control. Some just call that love. And here's what all three of these clauses have in common. And this is a part I need you to hear. None of them require predicting murder. That's the whole point. The internet will call them murder clauses. They're not. They're designed for situations families actually face every single day. A kid with an addiction, a beneficiary going through a toxic divorce, someone who burns through money the second they get it, a family member whose mental health makes financial decisions dangerous. These clauses exist in thousands of trusts across the country, drafted by estate attorneys who are thinking about addiction and irresponsibility and manipulation, not homicide. The fact that they also protect against the unthinkable is exactly why they matter. You don't build a fire escape because you expect a fire. You build one because the building code says you should. And when the fire comes, you're grateful someone thought of it. I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice. Every state has different rules about how these provisions are drafted and enforced. What works in California may not work in the same function in your own state. If you are thinking about this might be a wake-up call for a lot of people. Talk to your own estate attorney, but have the conversation. That's the ask. Just have it if you are lucky enough and fortunate enough to be in a position where you have a trust for someone you love. Most people sign their trust once and put it in a drawer, maybe a safe, maybe a filing cabinet in the home office that hasn't been opened since the kids were in elementary school. It's paperwork. It's the thing your attorney made you sit through on a Tuesday afternoon when you would rather have been anywhere else. You signed it, you forgot about it, and you went back to living your life. That's normal. That's what almost everyone does. The Reiners reportedly set up that trust in 93 for an infant. 32 years later, the terms of that document are allegedly the reason a judge will decide whether more than $1 million flows to a defense team or stays frozen. Not because the trust was written badly, because it was written for a world that doesn't exist anymore. The child grew up, the circumstances change, the document didn't. Robin Michelle Reiner allegedly had decades to update that trust. Decades, when according to reporting, the warning signs were there. The substance issues, the erratic behavior, the crises that reportedly got worse over time. At any point, they could have sat down with an attorney and said, we need to add protections. We need a discretionary structure. We need behavioral triggers. We need an indictment or freeze. Any one of those conversations at any point over 32 years, and the document in the drawer becomes a different document, a document that responds to reality instead of running on a schedule written before their son could walk. This isn't an indictment on them. This is, you don't think about these things. You think positively. You don't think about your son doing that to you. They didn't take those steps, though. And according to everything in the public filings, they repeatedly let the trust run on its default settings. And I'm not saying that to criticize them. I'm saying it because if you have a trust, that's probably what it looks like, too. Fixed ages, mandatory payouts, no conditions. The standard package your attorney put together because it covers the basics and nobody was thinking about what happens when the basics aren't enough. The trust is the last set of instructions your family will ever get from you. It speaks for you when you can't speak for yourself. And if it doesn't say what you mean, if it doesn't account for the person you're worried about, the situation you're trying to prevent, the thing nobody wants to say out loud at Thanksgiving, then it says nothing at all. It's just a vending machine. And vending machines don't protect anyone. If, like I said, you're fortunate enough to be in a position with a trust for someone you love, update the document. Have the conversation nobody wants to have because the law everyone assumes will protect your family shows up after the worst has already happened. The trust is what shows up before. Make sure it's ready. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I know most of us are like, yeah, wouldn't that be a nice world to live in? But you know, some do. Don't find yourself in the position this family is finding them in. Your thoughts in the comments section, Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Nobody said it. Not the LAPD, not a single source close to the investigation. Since Rob and Michelle Reiner were found dead in their Brentwood home in December, law enforcement has never publicly disclosed a motive for the killings. Then on June 9th, Nick Reiner's own civil attorneys filed a 136-page probate petition that I would say, in my opinion, kind of does it for them. I don't think they meant to. I think they were just trying to get their client his money. But what they put on paper is a date, a dollar amount, two people who reportedly controlled it, and two people who are dead. In any other case, that's page one of a motive brief. So let's stop dancing around it. Let's take what's been publicly reported, lay the pieces next to each other, and ask a question everybody's been thinking about, but nobody with a microphone has been willing to really say. Did $1.5 million give Nick Reiner a reason to kill his parents? Not saying it's right, but I'm saying, was that the carrot on the stick? But how is he going to get it if they're dead? Well, exactly. That's how he's going to get it. If they're dead, if they were the ones saying, we don't think you are capable of handling this right now. If that barrier is gone, the money's free. But Tony, he would be, how is he going to get it if he's accused of killing them? If he gets caught killing them, he's an addict. That's two thoughts. Oftentimes, there ain't a lot of multi-dimensional 4D chess playing going on with addicts. It's pretty much barrier. How can we destroy that to get to what we want? There's not the thought process of, well, if I murder them, I might be wanted for murder. I might get caught in this scheme and I might never get the money. No, it's just if they're dead, I get the money. That whole, oh, I might destroy my existence. That part is missed in that equation in the addict's brain. So if you're stuck on that one going, nah, that's it's not good reasoning. It's not good thinking. That's why it's addict thinking, but it's addict thinking with a carrot on a stick, and it's directly in front of us. Now, nobody has to prove murder in a court. That's not part of the equation here, but juries certainly like it. Juries certainly like to latch onto something and beyond just he's a shitty human being. We know that going in. But what makes him shittier is really the question. And this may be the answer. In my opinion, your thoughts in the comments section. There's no right or wrong here. I don't know for sure, but I'm going to examine this. There's one legal path, just one, where Nick allegedly kills them and still keeps the money. His defense team is reportedly already on it. So let's start where any investigator would start, not with the suspect, not with the crime scene, with the money. According to the petition, Rob and Michelle established an individual trust for Nick in 1993 with what his lawyers called unambiguous terms. Half at 30, the rest at 35, mandatory and unconditional. His 30th birthday was September 14th, 2023. He reportedly never got paid. That's not a dispute about inheritance. According to his own filing, that money had reportedly already vested. It was his legally on a date when both of his parents were alive and in control of the trust. His lawyer's own words, at the mandatory distribution date, those funds reportedly ceased to be trust property. And the petition offers no explanation of why Rob and Michelle didn't distribute it when they were alive. You can take 1,000 guesses as to why. They thought they were being responsible parents with a son that had been battling addiction his whole life. And at the moment he turned 30, was still living with them, had come off a conservatorship not that long prior. We've talked about that in great detail on this channel. And they were trying to not put something in front of him that would make him destroy his life even more than he already has. Now, granted, he got his allowance from them. They controlled that, but $10,000 a month is very different than $1.5 million suddenly accessible in a bank account. $10,000 is a lot to just destroy your life with. Trust me, it's far more than an addict should have access to. Certainly, you know, perspective on realistic terms of money and monetization and paying and taking care of your addict son, you know, this is how it worked in their household. Good, bad, you can argue it 50 ways to Tuesday. Was it smart? You know, it is what it is. It's how they were trying to handle it and get by and keep everyone breathing. The petition offers no explanation of why Rob and Michelle didn't distribute it when they were alive. 27 months, they were alive. They controlled the trust in terms. The terms were reportedly very clear and nothing happened. So while they were likely taking a humanitarian stance, if you will, a loving stance, I'm doing this for your own good because I love you, I care about you, and I know what you're capable of stance, that doesn't necessarily always equate to a legal stance. He could have just sued them. Yes, he's a lazy addict. Guess where he'd have to get the money for the attorney to sue the people from? Mom and dad. He makes $10,000 a month on an allowance. Yeah, you don't think that that's not going somewhere else other than attorney fees? He didn't have the willpower. He didn't have the mental capacity. He didn't have the resources to sue the hand that feeds him. That's not a disadvantage to him. That's just reality of where things stood. Get your act cleaned up. Get your life together. Do something decent. Money's probably yours. Keep being a fuck up. Mom and dad are going to hold on that money until God himself says you have to hand it over. And that might be where we're at this point. The reporting tells you why they reportedly hesitated. Nick was 2 years out of an involuntary conservatorship for grave disability, still living in their guest house with no income and no independence. Any parent of that position holds back, mandatory terms or not. But reasonable to whom? To the man in the guest house who reportedly knew what the trust said and watched 27 months go by without a check, every minute ticking away? Every second. Dollars that were not in his hand to find his next fix. I'm guessing Nick saw it a little differently. If you strip it down to the frame, a documented financial entitlement, a documented failure to pay, and the only two people who reportedly stood between Nick and that money are the same two people who ended up dead. In any investigation, that's not a coincidence you file away. That's a motive you build a case around. But he wanted money isn't a motive that explains this. If it were that simple, it wouldn't have taken 27 months to reach a breaking point. Half the people in prison for financial crimes had the patience to plan. Whatever allegedly happened in that Brentwood home wasn't patient. Which means the money alone doesn't get you there. The money had to land on something that was already burning. And by all reported accounts, it was. A former rehab roommate reportedly described rage towards Rob and Michelle that went back to when Nick was 15. Resentment towards their fame, their control, everything they imposed on his life. That anger was reportedly documented long before anyone was talking about a trust fund. It didn't need money to exist, but money gave it a target. Money gave it a document. Money gave it proof, in his mind, allegedly, that the people who controlled his life were now controlling his finances. It's a photograph from September 14th of 2024. It's Nick's 31st birthday. The entire Reiner family together at dinner in Las Vegas. Everybody smiling. A full year after the distribution was reportedly due and never paid. Whatever was building behind the smile didn't stop. 15 months later, Rob and Michelle were dead. That's what his slow burn motive looks like. Not a snap. Not a single bad night. Compounding resentment with a dollar sign attached to it. And the question you guys should be asking is, why 27 months? Why did it reportedly take that long to go from unpaid trust to alleged double homicide? That question has an answer too. And the answer is what separates this from a simple greed motive. If you're sitting on a legitimate grievance and the trust terms reportedly make this a legitimate grievance, not a delusion, and your brain is working the way it's supposed to, you call a lawyer, you file a petition, you fight in court. That's what healthy people do with real injustice. They use systems. Nick's civil lawyers eventually did exactly that in June of 26. The question is reportedly, what happened during the 27 months before that filing existed? Well, paranoid ideation doesn't invent grievances out of nothing. What it does, when a real grievance exists, is strip away every rational response and replace them with certainty. Not suspicion, certainty. The kind that feels real. More real than anything else or anyone else tells you. Certainty that the people withholding your money aren't being cautious. They're your enemies. That this isn't a disagreement, this is a conspiracy. And everyone who claims to love you has been working against you your whole life. If the reported diagnosis is accurate and the paranoia was active, the money wasn't just unfair, it was
evidence. It was confirmation of everything he reportedly believed since he was a teenager. They were stealing and holding his money back. And what do you do to people who are conspiring against you, holding life, your very future against you, prohibiting you from taking that step that you so deserve to take?
You have to destroy them, right? That's what 27 months means. That's what was going on in those 27 months. All of that thinking, stewing, brewing every single damn day. A healthy brain processes a financial dispute and hires a lawyer. A brain reportedly affected by schizophrenia, compounded by reported substance abuse, processes the same dispute and goes to war. The delay isn't evidence against the motive. The delay is evidence of how long the fuse was. In 3 to 4 weeks before the killings, somebody reportedly lit it. The medication switch. Sources described it in one word. Bursts. Erratic. Dangerous. Out of his head. A complete break from reality. Medical staff reportedly warned Robin Michelle not to let Nick stay at the home. They let him stay. The switch didn't reportedly start the war. It removed the last ceasefire. Whatever the original medication had been holding in place, the stabilization, the managed paranoia, the barely functional equilibrium was gone. And the grievance, the resentment, the substances were still right where they'd been. But then December 13th, 2025 comes around and the Christmas party at Conan O'Brien's house. Multiple sources reported that Nick and Rob got into a very loud argument, heated enough that Rob and Michelle left. A source reportedly said Nick had been supposedly off drugs, but was not so much off them. The substance of the argument has never been publicly reported. Nobody has said what it was about, but it was the last known interaction between Nick and his parents before they were found dead. And every factor I've just laid out was reportedly in the room that night. I'm not filling in that blank. I'm telling you the blank exists, and the shape of everything around it points in one direction. But let's examine. Why didn't he take the legal route? He had the same right to file a petition in 2024 that his lawyers exercised in 2026. If the trust terms were that clear, a court could have forced the distribution. He didn't need to kill anybody to get $1.5 million. He needed a probate attorney, right? Well, that's exactly the point. A rational actor files a petition. A rational person doesn't end up charged with double murder over money he could have won in court. The motive theory doesn't work if you assume Nick was thinking clearly. It works precisely because, by all reported accounts, he wasn't. The convergence is the theory. The real financial grievance processed through a brain reportedly in psychiatric freefall, amplified by reported substance abuse and stripped of its last chemical restraint by a medication change that sources say left him unable to distinguish his enemies from his parents. Or maybe in his mind, they were the same people the whole time. It's not a motive. That's something worse. That's a grievance motive that allegedly ran through a broken mind until the original injury was unrecognizable, until the $1.5 million wasn't about money anymore. It was about everything they'd ever done to him, everything they'd ever controlled, everything he'd reportedly been saying since he was 15 years old. A rational motive leaves a rational trail. This one, if it does happen to be real, allegedly left two people dead. And a suspect picked up 20 miles away near a metro station. That's not a plan. That's an explosion. Which brings us back to the part I said was coming. The one legal path where Nick allegedly kills his parents and still keeps the money. California Slayer statute. Kill someone feloniously and intentionally, lose your inheritance. A murder conviction reportedly wipes Nick out entirely, but an NGRI verdict, not guilty by reason of insanity, potentially negates the intentional elements the statute requires. California appellate courts have reportedly indicated that a person found NGRI may not be deemed to have acted intentionally for probate purposes. The law is reportedly unsettled, but it is the only path where someone who allegedly killed the people who created the trust still has a claim to what's inside of it, at least part two of it, the 35-year-old payout that is yet to come. Slayer statute would apply there. It would apply to the bigger chunk of inheritance, but it's still, the legal system is looking at it, may not really apply to that $1.5 million that he was supposed to get at 30. If you follow this logic, if money was the grievance that allegedly drove everything, then the insanity defense isn't just a strategy to avoid prison. It's also potentially the only defense that preserves the financial entitlement at the center of the entire case. The defense doesn't just fight the charge, it protects the prize as well. The same mental illness that may have turned a financial dispute into an alleged double homicide is also the same mental illness that might shield the money from the Slayer statute. The disease and the defense are the same thing. And the circle keeps closing. Alan Jackson, the attorney who withdrew in January when the funding reportedly dried up, has now said he's willing and ready to come back if the money becomes available. His parting words, pursuant to the law in California, Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder. It's not an innocence claim. That's an insanity defense. Straight up. And as of June 12th, the newly appointed trustee has reportedly agreed to ask the court to release the funds. The money Nick reportedly wasn't getting, the money that may sit at the center of why two people are dead, is reportedly about to be handed to the man accused of killing the people who are withholding it. So he can hire the lawyer who will reportedly build the defense that might actually let him get more. It's there's so many layers. This, you're like, oh, he'll get the 1.5 million maybe, but there's no more he's going to possibly get after that, right? Huh? Go for the insanity defense. Might be living high in a mental hospital the rest of your life, but you'll be living high in a mental hospital. I want to be clear about what this is. No law enforcement agency has confirmed money as a motive. No prosecutor has argued it. This is completely based on what's out there, in my opinion. But the reported facts don't really need much help. Documented entitlement. Withheld. Two gatekeepers dead. A lifetime of reported resentment that a money gave a target to. A reported psychiatric condition that may have turned a grievance into a war. A medication change that reportedly removed the last restraint in an argument the night before that nobody can explain. A defense strategy that protects the very entitlement that may have started all this. And that trust fund that is reportedly about to be released. Every road in this case leads to $1.5 million, the alleged motive, the attorney's reported withdrawal, the attorney's reported return, the petition, the trustee's reported decision, the defense. Nobody has said it was about money. But the two people who stood between Nick Reiner and their check are gone, and the check, reportedly, is about to be written. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.